Hey, who? What? Get your hands up.
Stand where you are. Don't move.
Don't reach for them guns.
Take it easy, you galoots. Put away the hardware and relax.
That's Greg.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Wow, glad I checked. I didn't have my recorder running, but I do have it running now. Bruce, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
So when I wrote you earlier today, and I actually wrote on the Facebook page, says I don't have anybody. Who should I have? And then you suggested Rich Reynolds, which is a good suggestion. And then I said, well, how about you, Bruce? And you said, why not? So this is Bruce Duensing, which I have pronounced properly now, I believe.
Right.
You know, Bruce, I can't remember the name of, you've got, I think you have an older blog that I used to read, and then now you've got a newer one now that's not, doesn't seem as like UFO oriented. Can you, because of my laziness and rudeness, can you describe them for me, or is that all right?
Yeah, it's, the new blog is a transit of contingencies, and basically it takes the UFO subject and expands it into areas that I didn't cover in the previous blog.
What was in the previous blog? I remember a lot of the things you wrote about. I was writing at UFO Mystic at the time, and I would sort of look and say, "Oh my God, he's taken what I thought I was thinking of and taken it, you know, 10 levels past me." In mostly having to deal with, you know, how do people perceive things? How does our culture perceive things?
Right.
How do we process that through our minds consciously and unconsciously? And how does it affect the, you know, way we see the phenomenon? And
right.
Every time I looked at Bruce's site, there was something on there that was, you know, light years ahead of what I was saying, and it fascinated me. And we had a few online conversations, but this is the first time I've ever talked to Bruce in person at all, ever.
Yeah, and we're both improvising as we go along.
Yeah. I was out of town this morning or this afternoon when I first contacted you. Then I had to drive here. Then I had to make dinner. So when we were going back and forth, I said, well, first out of the gate, I've got this crusade I've been on for the last couple of years about the co-creation of the UFO experience and how it's probably really hard for not just the individual, but everybody that's kind of interested in it, people that study the phenomenon, all the way down to, you know, pop culture, to meet whatever it is, whatever the UFO, any paranormal thing, but I guess specifically the UFO thing is, on its own terms, whatever that might be, because we have so much baggage and everything going on in our subconscious before it even comes up to our consciousness so we remember it.
Very true.
Bruce also said that When I brought that up, he said, what came to mind was, we have no agenda here, we're just going to talk. What came to mind was the anti-structural nature of the subject and the search for context versus backfilling one, which is sort of what I just said, but a little more subtle.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that, one of the dynamics going on in the time we live in is that people generally fear complexity. And that boils down to reductionism, belief systems, and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, all this, you drill it down, and what you basically have is thought is based on an incomplete database. And so consequently, so is logic. And I think that a lot of what passes for consciousness are really images tied to imagination, which then that gets into semiotics and a lot of complexities where we don't really experience anything directly except through either processes we're not conscious of or language, which is a very comparatively closed system. It's very predictable.
Yeah.
And of course, then that gets back to thought being an incomplete database, you know. So you have all of these architectures, and the way I look at my aim is to deconstruct them, because all of this is based on what could be called liminal experiential anomaly, something at the fringe of consciousness. That also equates to interstitial spaces. You know, what's between A and B? And we seem to be filling up that space with architectures when, in reality, the phenomena itself is anti-structural. And what I prefer to do is open up those spaces between A and B and see what's there.
Well, what have you found? What, you know what? First, maybe we ought to tell people what your background is and why you're, I mean, because this is the first time we've talked, why you're interested right. in these kind of things. I mean, is it academic background or what drew you to it?
Well, basically, I've always had an interest in how things work, which equated back in the day to mechanics. And then that graduated to in an evolution over time to becoming a project engineer, which involved everything from construction, rehabilitation, drawing up plans, specifications, projected budgets, actual budgets, and then you get into aseptic biological processing of food additives. I mean, basically, I've always been an analytical person that always has suspicions rather than beliefs, kind of like Robert Anton Wilson. I think the questions are more interesting than the answers, I guess.
Yeah,
I've always been a curious guy, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, why UFOs and why that kind of anomaly as opposed to, right. you know, just pure psychology or something like that, or the psychology right. of perception.
Right. I think I've always been had a part of me that was always skeptical of the methodology in which I was taught. In other words, it was really rote repetition rather than learning how to learn. And I've always been curious by nature, and I think that a lot of things you can't learn in a book. And by experience, I was skewed over to the study of this phenomenon and all that it relates to by actually experiencing some anomalies myself, which I've never been able to answer. So I was kind of prompted into it. It wasn't really something that I made a conscious decision to, analyze.
What do you think happened to you?
I really don't know. I have to be honest. I really don't know. I'd be telling a lie to myself and therefore telling you a lie if I told you I knew. You know?
Do you talk about it to anybody, or you just kind of leave it because you don't want to ruin it by talking about it?
No, I've talked about it in the past and I've written about it. So, no, I don't believe that keeping it inside is a healthy thing. I really don't. I think a lot of people do, and I think that creates problems for them.
Well,
you know?
Yeah.
I think writing about it, it's like an exorcism. You know, you take it from inside and you put it outside, and then you can really take a look at it, you know.
Yeah. Well, I guess for context, is it okay if you tell us what happened to you and when, or what you think happened to you and when?
Well, the last one happened a couple days ago. Pardon?
I just laughed. I said, "What?" It's so because I've never really had any kind of. I think I've seen lights a long way off one time and a couple of times, and that was about it. No, nothing nearer than that, but.
Well, you know, I'm confident enough in myself where I can accept it and talk about it, mm-hmm. and I don't really care what anybody believes in what I say or not. I mean, I think that has to be the basis of any amount of sincerity. Otherwise, I'm wasting your time and I'm wasting, you know, everybody's time by leading them off on a fool's errand. And what happened a couple days ago, my son passed away about not quite 5 years ago. And I was rather, you know, I have sort of a guilty conscience about that, and I'm not afraid to say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking out loud about how, you know, the transience of life and so forth. And I was specifically geared toward putting it in the context of where we're all guests here. We're not really from here. We're passing through here. And I thought, you know, in a way, we're guests in somebody else's house. And as soon as I said that, a voice about twice normal speaking volume went, uh-huh. And I was like, okay. You know, and I really, you know, I told my wife and she was like, oh my God. And I was just like, well, I don't know, you know. I don't try and overthink it, you know, from that perspective when it happens.
Yeah.
It's just sort of like you accept it. And, well, I don't know where that came from or what that represents or anything, because you can get tangled up in your own shoelaces.
Yeah.
You know?
And the other thing is, it was probably something that I hate to guess on your behalf, but something that only had meaning for you. And if anybody else was sitting there, I dare say they might not have heard it.
Correct. That's very possible. You know, a lot of sounds, you know, in as far as, you know, anomalous studies and electronics, you know, have sounds that don't have any, vibratory molecular source.
Yeah. Like a microphone
right.
would not pick it up.
Right. That could be true, too. I mean, I just don't know, you know,
yeah.
which is why it interests me.
Or, you know, maybe a microphone would pick it up, but either would be very faint or wouldn't really be saying anything. But to you, it was this loud voice.
Right. Right, and I'm very familiar with the mechanical nature of sounds. That's all I've spent my entire life, you know, working in engineering and that sort of thing on projects, and this was something just way out of context, which is pretty much, you know, describes anomalous experiential realities. You know, it's just totally out of context.
Yeah. Do you have what was the precipitating experience? Do you even remember, or is it just little things have been going on all your life?
Yeah, they really peaked about maybe a decade ago.
Uh-huh.
And then they've just been very, of course, unpredictably spaced.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, 6-8 months, a year will go by and nothing happens. And then suddenly, once again, you know, it just pops up out of context, and I have no idea why it does, you know.
Yeah, well, it's...
So a lot of this, you know, a lot of this is, you know, I think the difficulty of all this is that a lot of this is self-referential. You know, mm-hmm. in other words, I can think about it, but on the other hand, language is a closed system, you know, and I'm dealing with something that appears to be an open system that somehow, and I think this generally characterizes all experiential anomalies, is that it takes a prosaic and puts it out of context. You know, it's like an open system meets a closed system. You know, and then you have semiotics. You know, which is the idea that, you know, you have signs and we have identifiers, and mm-hmm. between signs and experience, we have concepts, and on the other side we have what's convention, what's language, what's logic. And somehow in all of that, the prosaic, or, you know, the normal becomes paranormal, you know.
Yeah, but I'm trying to see if I'm understanding you, because I would say that during any kind of paranormal UFO experience, if it's close enough, I suppose, if you right. want to talk about Valet or something like that, but the closer something is, there is a precipitating stimulus, if you will, and while that stimulus could be anything. And our problem here
right.
is it's going through probably, you know, 100 different filters before it
right.
becomes an experience in your head. And it goes through those 100 different filters probably in less than half a second.
Right. Well, and, you know, the brain, the physical brain, has an actual processing speed. And, you know, today I was just... I saw the lecture that was moderated by Dean Radin over at Northwestern University by a brilliant young lady scientist by the name of Julia Mossberg. And if somebody goes to Dropbox.com, they can listen to the lecture, and it's exactly what you're saying. Science is far ahead of ufology in those terms, you know?
In what way could that be useful?
Well, I think it's useful in that there's a neurological component to this. I mean,
right.
we can't experience anything, you know, without the physical brain. But there's a part of the physical brain, like Stuart Hammerhoff and some others, have found microtubules in the structure of neurons where two states can be held simultaneously.
Huh.
And what that means is a quantum connection to information, you know, and then you get into Valet's theory of information, which is, I think, at the nexus of this whole thing, is because he can really almost summarize the entire spectrum of anomalous experience by an information exchange that we don't understand the processes by which those things occur.
Well, is there any way to get towards an understanding of it without... Well, see, the problem is we've got language and concepts we've already got to try and get
right.
to the center of that. But if we are hammering away at the fly with the sledgehammer... what would kind of be a first step in peeling that back? It sounds like what you said a few minutes ago, that's what you're trying to do, is decontextualize all this stuff so that we
right.
can start to maybe see a glimmer of what is going on its own terms, maybe.
Well, I think it goes into relationships, and all relationships are contingent upon their interdependence, which then you get into systems thinking, and then you get into, which a good primer is Gregory Bateson, who is the pioneer of cybernetics. Now, you talk to somebody who is in ufology, and it's like Rich Reynolds said, it was almost like a Zen thought, where you can't study ufology with ufology. And my look at this tells me that which any first-year physics student knows, and Valais has commented on, is that energy and information are one and the same thing. And he's gone so far as to say that, well, he asks fundamental questions like, why does time pass? Why do things fall down? Mm-hmm. And all of this is related to space-time, you know? You have coincidences, you have synchronicities, and you know what's interesting is whether it's NDE or a UFO experience, what are we talking about? We're talking about an enormous amount of energy. So does that equate to an enormous amount of information?
Well, you could look at it from the other side, too.
And if so, how do our internal processes that are largely unconscious process that information? And then you have the huge variability, the individuated memory bank or data store that people anticipate a result. You know, they could be confronted with something that is entirely without definition.
Novel, yeah.
And then, therefore, they fall back on these processes without even a conscious awareness of them because they're not conscious by nature. And so you have, you know, you have really what it boils down to is you have two different schools of thought going on right now. You have general relativity, and on the other side you have quantum physics, and like Valais says, they contradict each other.
Yeah.
And what he's saying is what's missing is the physics of information. And I absolutely agree with that, because if you distill all these complex issues down to basics, that's really the nexus of the problem, you know? Because you have the problem of space-time, you know, where, you know, in simple terms, you know, what we consider dimensions, you know, what Valais is saying, it's only information. You know, space-time took the place of time. And how do we measure time? We measure time by reference. Mm-hmm. We measure it by information. So again, you know, we have this illusion that time is linear, where physics is telling us it's not.
Right.
So in other words, I think the challenge is to deconstruct, you know, all the, what would you say, end runs and fool's errands that people avoid complexity. They're afraid of it, you know?
Yeah.
At least that's what it seems like to me. I don't know.
Hey, I'm afraid of it.
Well, so am I, but I feel like, you know, I got nowhere to run.
Yeah. But the thing is, it takes some real work. And I think the work of the physicality of it has been done, and probably has been done a long time ago. I don't know if the physicality of the experience, or what we think is the physicality of the experience, is going to gain us any more information, as you call it. Maybe you should explain how information is energy, since not everybody listening is a first-year physics student, including me.
Yeah. Well, essentially, and a good analogy would be the Matrix. That would be not an accurate one, but it's in the ballpark. And what that means is this, is that if you take energy, you can easily demonstrate that energy is information, because you take physics or you take any of the natural sciences, and what you're doing is basically in nature and in subatomic physics, you're talking about energy exchanges where energy is either stored or it's transmitted or what the alchemists used to call transmutation. It's all information that is carried by energy, whether it's the sun, solar energy going through the atmosphere, and the atmosphere certainly is transmuting solar energy into mm-hmm. atmosphere. It goes down in density, like the alchemists used to say, you know.
Yeah.
Then it goes into water, then it goes into earth, then it goes into crystals, then it goes into metals, and so forth and so on. So everything can be transposed, these energy exchanges, into knowledge or information. And unfortunately, our database or our knowledge is incomplete as to how all this fits together, you know.
Right. So if there is energy being transmutated or changed or transmitted during a paranormal encounter, if we come at it from that as an energy and information exchange, how does that change our ideas of what might be going on during an encounter with something that's heretofore unknown to the witness?
Yeah, I think a lot of this has to do with what's known as the observer effect. And, you know, and you probably are familiar with the double slit experiment.
Yes.
You know, and really one of the most interesting theories is it's synchronicities, or in other words, you know, you go into the witnesses in close encounters where you're dealing with a lot of energy, a lot of information, and you have a huge variability in what was witnessed, everything from blonde Venusians to, you know, small people to robots to whatever.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that has to do with anticipations. And this theory says that our anticipations are wrapped up in an observer effect. And what that means is that our anticipations cause effects in the future that cause present effects. Mm-hmm. In other words, again, you have to get rid of that concept of linear time.
Right.
You just have to get rid of it. It doesn't exist.
Yeah, it's instantaneous throughout what we perceive of time. All that information, whatever's happening, is always instantaneous.
Right. And that's the problem, is that ufology has not kept up with science.
Well, they're scared of complexity.
It's sort of become inbred and cartoonish, you know? For lack of a better way to describe it.
Yeah. So, you know, if we think about it in that way, and we're still not at the end of that, we've got much more to talk about that. But if we think about it in that way, then anything that anybody thinks ever about the subject contaminates the database, quote unquote, does it not?
Yeah, it does. And you know what's very interesting is there's another level to this, or if you will, a parallel set of circumstances within mm-hmm. this dynamic, which is Princeton University's experiments with man-machine interactions, in other words. Affecting software. And
yeah.
Then you have the next step, which was their global consciousness experiments with random number generators.
Yes.
And a lot of that seems to suggest that emotions as a component of consciousness serve as a carrier wave. In other words, what they found was the numbers lined up whenever there was something catastrophic going on.
Yeah.
And it was like the information, and again, we get back into information, somehow was exhibited coherence, where it shouldn't be coherent at all. And then you get back into the idea where consciousness is not really as individuated as we think it is. In other words, just think of a network of computers. You have individual computers that are networked.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing might apply to consciousness, where if you think about it, you know, the idea or the concept of energy moving in waves, therefore, you know, when the observer anticipations hit it, it falls wherever they decide it falls. And so you have a really interesting relationship where you almost wonder, and I wrote about this in an extended essay, where you have these cyclical waves of activity. And it almost makes you suspect that there's sort of a global anticipation, or if you will, like you said, something that precipitates, just like a weather system. You know, mm-hmm. the preconditions that exist in a form of shared consciousness that we have no understanding of except by theory, that somehow reaches a critical mass, and then suddenly we have a wave of activity.
Yeah, well, so it looks like from our point of view that heightened emotion is a way of, what's the word, collapsing the wave function or introducing
yeah.
non-randomness?
Yeah, what's interesting is that, yeah, I mean, again, I don't have any beliefs in this, just suspicions.
Yes.
But one of the things that's very interesting is, and again, the problem is how we classify what was formerly called UFOs, you know, where
yeah.
objects are metallic and they travel through interstellar space and all that, and that was supplanted by, you know, unidentified atmospheric phenomena. And the problem with all that is that it creates an artificial barrier based on semiotics that mm-hmm. somehow this phenomenon of what occurs in the atmosphere is completely isolated from similar occurrences, where they might share, if you will, a common principle or operating system.
Yeah, that makes sense. You're already artificially throwing something into a basket where that basket has been created for it, and it may not fit into that basket. It may fit into many baskets, but we're not even aware of it because we don't even know about the other baskets, or we don't even know that they're nearby, if you want to say that.
Right. There is, I don't know if you're familiar with Borges' idea, the Crimson Hexagon, which is basically a library of books that reaches into infinity. And every book has just one difference in it, which is analogous to thought. In other words, thought is always incomplete.
Yeah.
And what he envisioned was that there was a group of people within this library searching for the codex for the whole thing. Which is kind of entertaining to think about. I mean, I think the closest I've come is that as a result of exploring this through many different pathways, is that we don't exist in a monarchical universe.
Mm-hmm.
That
it's infinitely democratic, more like.
Yeah, you know, even think of the concept of extraterrestrials as being a variant of that. I mean, you have, and you know, control psychologically is always pathological. And I think it goes against the idea, which physics, again, has shown, that time's not linear. It's being recreated all the time. It's in a process of becoming. And I think this also relates to the idea that, again, going back into space-time, that it's a feedback process. It isn't just, we can't isolate the observer from what's observed. We can't.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible. You know?
Can we isolate, do you think we might be able to isolate the effect of something unusual or anomalous to the point where we would know that's what the effect was, even if it wasn't that anomalous thing. You know what I mean? Basically try to create a science of anomalies by looking at their shadows or signatures rather than what the experience might be. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head. I think that, and I went into this with Rich today, where I don't think this is a direct process. In other words, I think...
The minute you go directly, you ruin it.
Yeah, because seeing is not believing.
Yeah.
I mean, that goes all the way back to Plato. You know, I mean, it's yeah. pretty basic yeah. stuff, you know? And yet we go off on these crazy, mythologies that, you know, then you go into, you know, narrative, linear storylines that really backfills what we don't know, and most people are scared to death of it.
Yeah, well, uncertainty is a horrible thing. I mean, you say people are scared of complexity. I think they're even more scared of uncertainty.
Yeah, and there's plenty of it. And, you know, the irony is there's more and more of it all around us.
How so?
I think one thing that's kind of interesting is if you compare what Princeton came up with
mm-hmm.
as far as the results or the effects of something catastrophic of a global nature
yep.
and how it affected random number generators, what you're talking about is a catastrophic event causing deconstruction of this stability or this normative concept of everyday life. And what's even more interesting, you go into the studies, psychological studies that have been done about or concerning individuals who've had anomalous experiences, a lot of the precursors are deconstructive. In other words, they could be a string of bad luck. They
yeah.
could be depression.
Mm-hmm.
They could be dysfunctional family relations and that sort of thing. And that, and then you transfer that, again, you're dealing with emotions, and you're dealing with emotions as a carrier wave, it seems, it could be, in relation to global consciousness and the effects of that.
Yeah, there should be a way, considering this.
It almost opens up a window, you know?
Yeah, and it's a exceedingly indirect window that
right.
doesn't flatter our normal ideas of space, time, causality, all that.
Right.
So how do
right.
you, and I've been trying to figure this out for years, and if somebody does
yeah.
figure it out, they better shut up while they're trying to figure it out.
All I can say is what Robert Anton Wilson said. If anybody tells you they know what's going on, they're full of shit.
Yeah. No, my point was if somebody can figure out a way to poke at the cause of the UFO thing, and more importantly, how it interfaces with people and their consciousness and all that, and poke it back and see if
mm-hmm.
it reacts in some way,
that
would be very important. The only
you
problem,
know, you're saying exactly what Valet said.
Yes, and in fact, I heard him say something like that. But I
what he say? Well, he has this idea. Again, it goes back to an idea of a monarchical universe where
I think he tried it,
what
actually.
We're talking about, we have social control systems. There's no doubt about that.
That's
all, you know, civilization is about, and William S. Burroughs wrote about it and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But essentially, you know, you almost get the impression, whereas he says it's a thermostatic control system. I don't know if you remember that bit of it. Where what he's saying is it somehow influencing thought or how we perceive the world or our conceptual models of the universe.
Yeah.
And really, I don't see that. I don't see anything changing. And I think I almost, you know, sometimes I really strongly suspect it's almost like a mirror universe. In other words, it's like on the microcosmic level. Think about it. I mean, we can't see thoughts. We have an internal world, and on the other hand, we have an external world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, we're an isthmus between what's inside of us and what's outside of us. We dwell, you know, it's almost as if there's a middle universe.
Yeah, there's an uneasy mediation going on constantly.
Right, and it's always being created, hopefully.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's interesting is the universe might be, you know, as above, so below. It might be a mirror universe, whereas the universe is trying to define itself through us, and we are trying to define ourselves through the universe.
Yes, that's something that's been subsumed into religious ideas for quite a long time.
Right, but the idea is, you know, that most of this is based on, you know, anthropomorphism, where we project human characteristics,
yes,
into something that might be, and this goes back into systems thinking and quantum mechanics and all that, where it might be cellular intelligence. It might be intelligence without sentience.
Yeah.
It sounds like a contradiction, you know, but I don't think it is.
I think the sentience may come through interaction with us.
Right. Or, again, that middle ground.
Yeah. Because a long time ago on UFO Mystic, and I remember writing this, saying this thing that the UFO thing and a lot of paranormal things may exist, right, in the way the wind or waves or whatever exist.
Right.
And the only time
like
that
a
we,
weather system.
Or a weather system. And the only time that we can make any sense out of it is how it affects us. And it just sits,
right,
there going along its merry way.
But, you know, what's interesting is how much of this, and it's almost a litmus test of our evolution as a species, because we think of evolution in technological terms. But then, you know, like I said on Rich's blog, it's really knowledge versus being. In other words, you know, the subject was advanced consciousness. And in a sense, you know, this middle ground or this information exchange seems to create something that is not quite one or the other, but a combination of the both, you know?
Yeah, and we're looking at a shadow of what that is and trying to describe it with grunts.
Yeah, and it's kind of like the old Sufi saying, don't look at what's in my hand, look at what I'm pointing to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we're the dog looking at the pointing hand rather than what it's pointing
at. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But we have no way, with our present normal sensory apparatus, database in our heads, all that, to see what the finger's pointing at.
Yeah, because a lot that's the problem is that a good example of this is sight, our how we see the environment through our senses.
Mm-hmm.
And the brain tricks us because sight is not continuous. It's discontinuous. And the mind says, well, you know, it processes it in a manner where it seems continuous, whereas it's not.
Yeah, so it's like a film.
Right.
You're looking
exactly
at an infinite series of microsecond moments. Well, at least what your brain thinks is, and then turns into a continuum for your consciousness so you can deal with, you know, not getting eaten by the tiger or getting your hand burned or whatever.
Right, and then the process of the physical brain through neurons has a finite speed, processing speed, just like a computer does.
Right.
You know, so there's subconscious processes that we cannot, just like, for example, we can't be conscious of keeping our heart rhythms going. I mean, if we did, we'd all be dead, you know?
Yes.
And so a lot of these things go into areas where we have no access.
Some
and
people have access to some of it.
We just see the effect of things we have no awareness of internally, which then skews everything in a very, what would you say, reality tunnel, like Wilson would say, you know?
Yeah. I think some people have access to some of this.
I agree. I agree.
And
I think, and again, a lot of this has to do with ufology artificially separating itself from other anomalous experiential events.
Yeah.
Like a real good example, of this is Vallée wrote a report of just to put it simply, a UFO flying over a tree in this guy's backyard, right?
Right.
So he goes out, and Vallée believes in field work, which, you know, everybody prefers being on the internet or reading a book. But he went out and questioned this guy. And what it turned out, the report was completely in error. The guy just either misinterpreted what the witness said or what have you. And actually what happened was the UFO passed through the tree, not over the tree.
Yeah.
And so then you think about other phenomena that are ghost images.
Yes.
And you get into where you have local manifestations, like in classical ghost phenomenon, and then you have macroscopic phenomenon that seem to be more global. Now, is there a process? And that's my question. Is there a process linking what most folks would classify as separate phenomena, where I strongly suspect, I don't believe this, but I strongly suspect there's a relationship there. And again, in an information transfer, you know, what we anticipate. Sometimes I almost think when I see these accounts of EVP, I almost think we're dealing with what Stuart Hammerhoff would call a zombie intelligence. In other words, they're anticipating an answer. They get the answer that they anticipate, but the person or entity, whatever, that they assume is generating it, just because that's the way it appears to be, you know, right?
I think I understand.
It's entirely absent. It's just a form of cellular intelligence that is feeding back the question asked, just like a freaking computer.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. So in the incomplete feedback loop, there we have filled in the incompleteness of it.
Yeah. That's why I say, you know, I think we stand a stronger chance of getting closer to what the nexus of this is by all the work being done in science on the observer rather than what's observed. I think it's easier to do. I don't think you can...
Well, we have access to the observer.
Yeah, exactly. and the observer doesn't appear and disappear like a ghost, whether it's a spaceship or a ghost or what have you.
So you're advocating teasing the observer's perceptions in order to have a fuller picture of what the observer does when its perception is teased.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a real interesting, you know, there's all kinds of controversies going on about, you know, and, well, it gets back into biocentrism. I don't know if you've ever read that book, but what the author is saying is, well, you know, everybody talks about the Big Bang as the origin of the universe. Well, where did consciousness come from? You know? And it's a very valid question because nobody knows. Nobody even knows what it is.
No.
Now, think about that.
Well, there's people that think they know what it is.
Yeah, and then, you know, so you have people in ufology who can't see the indirect processes that create an effect, where they think it's just, well, you know, you can believe what you see. Well, if you go down that route, it's chaotic. It's incoherent. It doesn't make any sense. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. that's kind of my thinking of it right now, is that the observer is, it's kind of like working the problem, not from its source, but from a more accessible vantage point. I don't think we can ever, because, you know, the whole thing's anti-structural, you know, and unpredictable, whereas, you know, the observer, you know, is pretty much there. I mean, yeah.
And predictable. So if you throw something at the observer that is genuinely unpredictable,
right,
how does the observer handle it? And how do many observers handle it? And maybe how do many observers handle it over a period or through different trials or whatever? I don't know. I'm just you're making me think quite a bit about how this could be done, because I was thinking for a long time about Valet's thing. Let's tease the source and see what shadows the source throws up, instead of taking the car apart and seeing what makes the car work.
Yeah. Well, it's like what Valet said, you know. He's like, you know, I don't want to see what's on television. I want to open up the television and see what makes the television work.
Yeah. No, it was he wanted to go to the, he didn't want to watch the movie. He wanted to sneak up to the projection booth after the projectionist left and see what was up there.
Yeah, and it was the same thing. And it's funny that Robert Anton Wilson said pretty much the same thing. He said, you know, if you don't like the movie, well, you're the projectionist. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, that was something he said, what, probably 20 years ago, and now he has to include, you know, everybody sitting there watching the movie as part of the projection equipment.
Yeah, and then you throw in anticipation in there, and that's why I almost suspect that that's why we go into these unpredictable cycles of waves, where somehow anticipation and intention that probably has precursors in some kind of deconstructive process that opens a window, and suddenly you have a manifestation of something that's totally out of context.
Yeah.
And you know, what's funny is that John Keel said the same thing, God, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago.
Longer than that.
What was it? He gave a lecture. It was foretense and portents. And what he talked about, which was very interesting, which kind of even was prophetic in terms of the Princeton experiments, he said that it's very interesting that UFO waves occur at historically key moments, that they follow that. And I think it's still online on YouTube.
Very, I've got to see that. I've never heard that idea. I mean, it's fascinating, and in light of everything we've been saying here, it makes total sense.
Right.
Because there's an element introduced that's probably highly emotional for lots of people, and then the weirdness or whatever, the concretization of the weirdness becomes localized somewhere.
Yeah. That's what I suspect. And I think for some reason there must be a critical mass, a tipping point, you know, in all this. And I'm sure what it reminds me of is an analogy of a key, where, you know, everybody looks for a single bullet theory. And I think what you have is just like in a weather system, you have several parallel precursors that have to exist, just like in creating a tornado or a storm. There has to be several parallel key cuts to turn that key, and what that opens is an information exchange that's completely out of context with the, you know.
Well, then it would seem like you could, in some way, at least on an individual basis, open that up. I don't know how. It'd probably be kind of random, but you could control that, the opening and closing of it. I remember Raiden, when I was talking to him. Oh, no, this was Mario Pozzaglini suggested this, I think. And Raiden also, he took it one step further. He said, what I'd like to do is take a random number generator and put it in a psychiatric ward. And
that's
see,
interesting.
Yeah, and see what happens to it. There's ethical things going on with that, which I don't know how it could be an ethical thing, although I guess it might bother some of the patients if they knew it was there.
Right.
But just somewhere, or, you know, our juvenile detention facility or jail or any place where there's high emotion all the time.
You know, the only problem with that, and I think that's probably what he's alluding to, is, you know, the confidentiality of patient information. And, you know, those type of people are not likely to give their consent, you know,
right,
or be able to. Or, you know, you could go to, I guess, to a legal guardian, you know.
Yeah. Or you could figure out some way to not have it localized in the place where the stuff was going on, but somehow have a connection to it.
Yeah.
That's starting to sound like sympathetic magic, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. I think another way to do that, it would be very interesting, is I wrote an essay, I don't know, about 2-3 years ago, about how screwed up these so-called ghost hunters are, where they're really chasing what they think they will eventually become. And all the electromagnetic interference that is so completely contaminating. I mean, it's really funny. They go to the main fuse box and turn off the main fuse box, and yet power's going to the main fuse box. It's in the house. And
right.
what would be a really interesting experiment is cut off the power right at the pole, you know, and monitor the situation, then bring a psychic in and see what happens. And have a really accurate psychological profile of that medium. And first off, ask her what he or she anticipates, and then see what happens.
Yeah. I was saying, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I'm done. Well, again, we're dealing with complexities.
And yes,
that's always difficult.
Yeah, I realize when I'm talking to you, I'm making, you know, these tiny little stabs at trying to understand what's going on, exactly what you're saying. How can this
right.
be applied to the, you know, the UFO subject in a practical way somehow? I don't know.
Well, you know, what we're dealing with is making intangibles empirical.
Yeah, there's the problem.
Yep, and that's why I think physics is light years ahead of ufology. I mean, we're still stuck in the 1950s.
I'd say before that.
Yeah, you're right. And you know, it's really interesting. You go back into Keel's concept of fortents and portents, and you get into the concept of an information field, or what one physicist called the possibility of a quantum plenum. In other words, there's a ceiling to energetic information that surrounds the Earth like a sheath. And so then you go into, historically, what has been the shared conceptual anticipation of what would be seen in the sky by the state of technology that was just beyond the grasp of empirical science. And what you have is, you know, in World War II, you had radar-guided missiles following planes, which wasn't developed until, what, maybe 50 years later?
How do you mean? What do you mean when you say that?
Well, what I mean is that how these...
Oh, you're talking about Foo Fighters following planes?
Yeah, correct.
Oh, okay.
Right. And it seems to follow how you look at the development of lighter-than-air ships, or you talk about Zeppelins, and then you have the airship flap occurring just prior to having a working empirical model of it.
Yeah.
And again, you get into this thing where you almost have a feedback process, like Valet has suggested, where you're projecting information into the future, and then it's bounced back into the present.
Yeah, or what we perceive as the future, but the way we're right. experiencing it, it's pulling us along.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's a possibility. It's certainly a possibility because it seems to follow a pattern.
Yeah, well, what are people seeing now, though? I think they're...
Well, I think that gets into the metamorphosis of the phenomenon, because I think one thing that is really apparent is it never stays the same. It's dependent on who happens to be looking at any given time, qualified by what the consensus of anticipation is.
Yeah, and for anybody that would say, well, it's, you know, everybody sees little alien grays now, I would direct them to Albert Rosales's Humanoid Encounters site.
Right, right, right. And, you know, and then that gets into all kinds of psychological influences that are cultural. And, you know, back in the day, you didn't have the sharing of information instantaneously.
Right.
And I think some of what impacts what is experienced or what is witnessed is, again, this tipping point where you have X amount of potential observers sharing the same anticipation, which then comes to fruition and a manifestation.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting.
A self-fulfilling, whatever, you know, not prophecy, self-fulfilling feedback loop.
Yeah, an information exchange. You know, what's funny is that, as far as I know, since Bud Hopkins passed away and so forth, I used to get a kick out of the fact that he would give lectures at MUFON, which is a whole story in itself. But his influence, or the influence, or John Mack is another good example, I've noticed a waning of reported experiences in an aggregate sum since these gentlemen have passed on.
In what way? I mean, I think I know what you're saying, but in what way?
Well, in that there, for a time, there was a coherency of these ghost creatures that could pass through walls,
right.
You know, and just like a NDE experience, these people would be transported through a beam of light.
Yeah.
To, in this case, an aseptic environment that they were probed. And that's a real interesting metaphor just in itself.
Yeah.
As not literally, but as an information exchange that is interpreted as a physical examination. I mean, you have all these very interesting cultural influences that are shared and become, in a way, I wouldn't call it a meme, but a very...
Oh, you're cutting out.
...informational. It's just a psychosocial phenomenon, whereas I don't think it is. I don't think everyone is lying. You know, I think when people say they experienced it, I think they did, but not in the way they interpret it.
Yeah, well, that was a question that a lot of people I knew were asking very soon after that, and after reading Ridley Strieber and all this, is if somebody else is sitting in the room at the same time, or more importantly, if they're sitting 10 miles away with binoculars, what would they see? If they could see right into the person. Okay, if they were looking at it with like a TV camera or something, what would they see at that point? Would they see mist floating through the room? Would they see beings taking the person out of there? Would they see the person jerking around on the bed? Would they just see the person sleeping there? I would like to talk to one of the researchers that wouldn't be too offended by the question and say, has anybody, because there have been multiple witness, you know, things right. going on, everything right. in between, where half the people didn't, or one person didn't, or one person did, and none of them, the rest of them did. But I'd like to find out if there was some sort of shared experience where the percipient in this kind of a scenario, like an abduction scenario, and a witness right. not connected to the scenario. And I'm gonna leave aside the Linda Napolitano floated out of the window thing. And
oh my God! Yeah,
I will leave that aside for now. But how many of how many of those are there where there is a shared experience by somebody who's within the experience and someone who conceivably is outside of that experience?
Well, maybe another way to approach it would be by telemetry. I don't know of a case, and you can fill me in if there is such a case. I've never heard of someone who, you know, and this is pretty atypical, where you have somebody who claims to be abducted or thinks they've been abducted, what have you, and I've never heard where, okay, this guy or lady has gone through several of these experiences. Why don't we run some telemetry in the room with them, because these are normally occurrences at night, and see what's going on in the environment in terms of their brain functioning, in terms of any anomalies in the electrical field of the environment, so forth and so on. I've never heard of that being done.
Yeah, that would be interesting. There's been plenty of people trying to leave cameras running, and then
right.
they go off at the right time or just the right, wrong time or whatever. But the telemetry idea would make sense, because you would be one removed from that, and maybe the whatever had stopped those recording devices had something to do with electromagnetic disturbances in the local area. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, that goes along with Persinger's ideas of environmental causes, which I'm not fully convinced of, but it's an interesting idea.
Yeah. Well, the problem with a lot of people is they have the nothing but thing, and then they kind of stop there.
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting is he wrote a book, God, I don't know, it was like maybe 20, 30 years ago, maybe even 40 years ago, where he took
the Space-Time Transients book?
Yes. Where he took the old punch card computer system and tried to correlate the data that way. Environmental data, I should say.
Yeah, I can't remember what he came up with. I think Valet also did, he did the punch card thing with the, very early on, just by trying to find out the situation in which things had happened. And he came up with that Wednesday phenomenon, I think, and a few other things. But that's another thing. If you've been listening to the show, I've been whining about a worldwide, all-inclusive database of as much information as possible, and then that information can start to be reconfigured, massaged, whatever, to search for patterns. Maybe
even have you heard about this collaborative effort between Bigelow and Valet?
No, I haven't.
Okay. He presented a paper, and what they've been working on, remember that whole thing with James Carrion and MUFON under contract to Bigelow?
Yes.
Okay. What was behind the scenes is, you probably know, Valet is a paid consultant to Bigelow.
Yes.
And that what Valet has been doing is, it's incredible, and I'm surprised this isn't reported on in the press. I think people enjoy their fantasies more than they do.
Well, this is why I want to talk to him at some point this year.
Yeah, because what Valet did is, and his specialty, and he's one of the pioneers of computer science, developed a software system for Bigelow to do exactly what you're describing. any combination of data points that you want to explore, this system will bring them up for you and compare them and contrast and everything else.
I don't know where I got the idea from. Maybe I got that from Valet too, but I always thought that that would be quite interesting. And maybe when he's on, if he's not, which he will be, I'm sure, bound by some non-disclosure, at least talk about the idea of it.
Well, he already presented the paper that describes it pretty well.
Oh, well, then I'd love to see that paper. Did he describe anything that they've run through it and any possible results?
No. He just described the software system as he designed it.
Oh, okay. He just needed the money to get it up and running, which Bigelow provided.
Right. Which, that Bigelow's a whole subject in of himself.
Yes, I know.
Yeah. But it should prove interesting. I would suspect, and again, I don't have any beliefs, just suspicions. I believe that if they have some sort of pattern recognition, I think they will make that known. And here's why. Valet gave, I don't know if you're familiar with the recent talk Valet gave, I think it was in Switzerland. And, you know, he's a high-tech entrepreneur.
Yeah.
That deals with investing in technological development.
Right. Venture capital.
Right. And one of the very interesting things he said in this talk was, I'm trying to remember the title of it. Just give me a moment. I could probably remember it. It was a talk given in Geneva, and I'm trying to think of the name, because the name is really key to this. I know. It was The Age of the Impossible and Anticipating Discontinuous Futures. And what he said was that it was very interesting, because as a venture capitalist, he was saying, you know, in the past, for example, you have a company like General Motors or any number of very, very large companies. And what he's saying is that their failure in the past could have been predictable. That would have occurred over several months, whereas GM and several of these companies went under in a day. And nobody could predict that. And what he's saying is it isn't that they're too big to fail. What they're saying is they're too interconnected. And in the middle of this, I mean, talk about out of context.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, it's really worthwhile. He just totally jumps his subject, and he starts talking about, well, and the oval objects that are in the sky, you know, in terms of what we thought was impossible becoming a reality. And the velocity of that seems to be occurring, what would you say, or increasing. And right in the middle of this talk about venture capitalism, he starts talking about UFO phenomenon. Very interesting. And it's almost like he's signaling, you know, and again, maybe I'm reading into it, but it seems so out of context. It's almost like he was trying to signal something, and I don't know exactly what it was, because he was very intentionally vague about it, but yet specific in bringing that subject up in a totally out of context relationship, you know, with the subject.
Yeah, well, that sounds like part of his possible experiment in trying to tease the subject or the source of it or the perception of it in a way that in a novel way to change it in some way or change how it's perceived or change how it presents itself to us. If there is a consciousness on that side.
I almost wonder, I mean, again, I'm connecting two points on the map without any real evidence, but my suspicion is it has something to do with that software program he's developing in conjunction with Bigelow.
Oh, okay. Oh, you mean it wasn't that? It might have been had a very practical reason.
Right. It's very interesting to watch it talk, you know.
Is that also available somewhere?
Yeah, it's on YouTube under TEDx.
Oh, that thing. Okay, the TED Talk. Okay, I understand now.
Yeah. So it's very interesting. I mean, it may mean something, it may mean nothing. But he certainly made it a point to interject that in the context of what we think is impossible now is possible and it's unpredictable.
Well, maybe he's trying to pull something into the present from the future too.
Could be. I don't know, but it could be. I mean, you know, I think the best any of us can do is have suspicions. You know, yeah. I really do. I don't think any of us. I think we can get closer to the phenomenon. I think science has gotten a lot closer to the phenomenon than any ufologist ever did. You know?
Right.
But
the thing is that it's not in a way that describes aliens or governments hiding them or beings coming from other planets and structured craft. It doesn't fit any of those little models, so it's ignored.
Right. Well, I think the other problem is, and I know this is something you're intimately familiar with, is the problem is that no respectable scientist would study this due to the fact, I mean, in specific context of UFOs, due to the fact that ufology as a social movement has just crept in their own backyard so much.
Yeah.
That, you know, you have a lot of money and funding and credibility and peer pressure, blah, 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 that, you know, the social movement has pretty much killed the science end of it.
Right. Well, I gave a lecture a few years ago, and the point of the lecture was, and it was the last one I gave publicly for some reason. I guess nobody's invited me since then. And the point of the lecture was, stop UFO research, stop all the large organizations, and concentrate on small ones who do work quietly,
right,
and maybe communicate with each other on the internet, and do not trumpet any kind of, you know, the only problem is that the problem is that this has to be run by people and people have egos and that screws everything up.
Right.
The best way, I think, to find out what's going on is to do some stuff where you, one, do not lust after results, two, right, maybe not know what the result is or be ready to change it on a, you know, change that result or your expectation of it at a moment's notice, and three,
right,
and the most important part is don't talk about it.
Right.
For as long as
right,
you possibly can.
Well, see, and then you get into that, and what you're describing is that same feedback loop we talked about earlier.
Yeah, I think what you know, in some unconscious way, or I've been paralleling what you were saying just by saying,
right,
you know, try and remove, especially ufology, but maybe even research, quote unquote, out of the equation.
Right. I think what would be interesting is to have what you described in a manner where, and you know, in a way, that's what Villay and Bigelow are doing.
Yes, exactly. I never really thought about it that way, but you are exactly right. They're doing it that way. God,
and
if I ever have him on the show, he may refuse to come on the show now.
Well, I...
I know what you're doing, Mr. French guy.
That could be.
I know what you're doing. And he'll say, well, I will have to talk about it, so it will ruin it, so forget it.
Yeah. But I really, that's why I think, in a way, it's kind of interesting, is I think the biggest development in the study of this phenomenon is going on behind closed doors.
It better be.
And, you know, what's so interesting is that, you know, everything else is backfilled. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like what Paul Kimball said. The study of ufology is really the study of sociology.
Yeah, basically. And the thing is that once you understand what the, you know, what the mammalian politics are going on, it follows
right.
that script exactly over and over and over again. And it's been doing it
yep.
since, I don't know since when, but especially since probably 1989 in Bill Moore's speech.
Yeah, it's really funny, you know, when you talk about cycles and epicycles and all that, what's interesting is that they say history is cyclical and only the players change. They all follow the same, recycling pattern of disseminating information that they have no idea how accurate it is, and then they go ahead and have the freedom to interpret it freely according to what they anticipate out of the phenomenon.
Yes, for the same reason that Shakespeare's plays are and Greek tragedy and plays done back then are exactly the same and exactly appreciated by people in the same way they were then that they are today.
Yeah, they're timeless.
Because people, the psychology does not change. And
no, and, I agree.
Maybe Eastern, you know, there may be, and I don't know about any Eastern, you know, forms of theater. Those explicate the Eastern mindset or whatever culture those came from.
Right.
And those are still popular because those are, you know, those are built into the culture and the genetics and everything of those people too. So,
yeah, it's almost like the genetics of cultural memory.
Yeah. And you're kind of fated to run that script unless
right.
unless you try really hard to be conscious of it and not run that script. Try to do anything that you normally do and not do it anymore. What I'm trying to do now is two things. One is not to care about what people think about me, which is really, really hard. And the other thing is not to get mad in traffic, which is really, really, really hard.
Yeah,
now, apply that to most people. You know, and everybody. It's
yeah.
really, really hard for anybody to escape their genetics, their programming, their culture, the people around them.
Right.
You know, you'd have to, you know, why do mystics go off and live in a cave in the mountains? You know that immediately now because it's really hard to do anything if you don't do that, to change
yeah,
yourself.
Yeah, you know what it is? It's an old thing called self-observation, which is almost... at times impossible. It's like chewing gum and walking at the same time. You know, it really is. It's very, very difficult. I find it sometimes, a real challenge to watch my reactions while I have them.
Yes. I try to take the observation out of it and just realize, well, then I guess the observation is, oh, I'm doing that again.
Yep.
And how do you do
it's
that?
Funny.
How do you do that with ufology, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I agree with that, absolutely. You know, it's funny. There actually is a word for that, and it's social scripting.
Ah, yes.
And what's even odder about it is, and that's what I said on Rich's blog today, was that it's really interesting, you know, how we evaluate this phenomenon in that we think of advanced beings as being technologically superior, and that's a subject he brought up, rather than, you know, we've advanced in tool making. Certainly we have, whether you consider it art or you consider a machine or computers or whatever. Our tool making ability has certainly evolved, but from the standpoint of being or being self-aware, I don't think we've made any progress at all.
No, hardly any, except there's some people. Oh, there's your siren, so you know that it's a real Rowdy Mysterioso show.
There you go.
We'll let that go by.
Cue in sound effects.
Yes. It's so hard to escape that programming that I think the only way to escape it is to become exceedingly conscious of its presence.
Yeah.
And the only way, and the only way to do that is to not have, I think, is to do it in an individual or very small group, like two or three people.
Yep.
Plugging away at a problem.
Yeah, I don't think anybody can do it alone.
Maybe not.
I think what it is that you need, you know, unless you're keenly aware of self-aware in a sense that would be beyond what one would normally experience, you almost
Well, then you wouldn't care about UFOs.
Yeah, it's like a, a monitor.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you could get to that point, the UFO problem, the paranormal problem, would not, it would be meaningless to you.
Yeah, probably.
Not meaningless like stupid or meaningless like let's ignore that. Meaningless like meaning, well, of course.
Yeah, it would become, what would you say, it would divest itself of a lot of social scripting and baggage.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I refer to it as a cargo cult.
Yes, yes. I think a few other people have said sort of the same thing.
Yeah. It's sort of like, you know, desire. What do you desire? You know, I remember one time I had a conversation online with Colm, who used to be in charge of research for Bigelow's, what was it, NIDS?
Yeah. You mean Colm Kelleher, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we were talking about, the discussion was centered around, I asked him a question. I said, well, let's say you met an extraterrestrial, what would you ask them? And he said, Bruce, I can't believe it.
A
couple of months ago, I was talking to a Siberian shaman, and he asked me the same damn question.
Did he have an answer? Did he have an answer?
Well, what he said was he didn't know. And it's very interesting in the sense that we go back into that whole feedback process of what do we want from it? What do we want? And then you get into, if you go into, what do we want? Then you get into what is its purpose.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing follows the other, where it might not, and that's what I was trying to say in Rich's blog, is that it might not have a purpose as we understand or experience purpose, you know?
Yeah, it has a purpose in the way a whale lives, or a, or like I said, the waves just wave, the wind just blows.
Yeah.
And we invest it with almost, some sort of purpose.
Yeah, it's sort of like Taoism, you know?
Yes.
If you can describe the Tao, it's not the Tao, you know?
Yeah, well, sorry. Here comes another siren.
Yeah, we're so loaded with...
There it goes.
We're so loaded with identifications and associations... and, you know, imagination connecting images to semiotics that derive meaning, and thought being having an incomplete knowledge base. Again, I think a lot of this is, and you can see it in the social movement, a lot of this is driven by imagination. It has absolutely nothing to do with anything. It's sort of a self-feeding feedback process.
Yeah, I would put that question to you and see how you reacted to it. You know, if you met an extraterrestrial, what would you say to it? And then I'll tell you what I would say.
Yeah, and I think my question would be, what am I?
Your question to it would be, what are you?
Yeah.
What am I, you would say.
What am I?
Yeah.
I think all relationships are comparative.
Yeah.
And I might not find out what I am, but I would have... And I think that's the whole problem with planetary culture, our culture, is we're so freaking isolated that were almost like a bunch of folks who the cast changes every generation, and every generation arrives here not knowing why they arrived there, you know. and then you have this thing where any answer is better than no answer.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. That's the uncertainty thing that people can't live with. If I saw an extraterrestrial, I thought that what was one, what would I ask it? The first thing I would say is, I don't believe in you.
Yeah. That's,
and see what happens.
That's even better. That really is very good. I mean, and the second part is, and see what happens. yeah. And, you know, what would be interesting is what the response would be.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'd like, after you talk about this relational thing the whole time, that's the first thing I thought of was, instead of asking a question, pushing it away and see what pushes back.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'd be something I totally did not expect.
Yeah, it's kind of like, in a sense, we don't let the phenomenon speak for itself.
Yeah, maybe that's it. You know, just by saying I don't believe in you, you have erased what I was trying to do by saying that without really thinking about it too much, was erase a lot of that baggage right up front to see what happens. Because it would be really hard for me to say I don't believe you when there is something physically apparently in front of me that I can see, touch, feel, and maybe smell, you know?
Right. Well, I think the aim, one aim I think that is worthwhile pursuing is deconstructing ufology, taking that architecture and seeing, you know, like going behind the television and see what makes it work. And I think there are a lot of drivers in that relate to social scripting, that relate to uncertainty, that relate to desire.
A need for certainty.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's like, it's almost like a single bullet theory. It's like, well, if an extraterrestrial landed, everything would be answered. Where I think behind that would be any extraterrestrial that landed would have questions of their own and not be omniscient.
Yeah. I mean, you're implying, just by using that language, you're implying the script of it already.
Yeah. And you're setting yourself up to be lied to.
Yeah.
You know,
and
to
lie to
yourself.
Yeah,
it's a perfect situation.
Yeah, and to lie to yourself.
Yeah.
So what do you say?
It's very interesting.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. What? No, you go ahead. What? I'm sorry.
It's all very well that we sit here and have this fun, enlightening, and really cool conversation. However, somebody may be listening and saying, well, what do you say to somebody that's been abducted and had the crap scared out of them and all that? There is nothing really you can say to that person, because you'd have to reference it outside of what they perceive happened to them. So what do you do with that?
I think you put a question in their mind. I think you provoke thought in them. I think you give them a menu of possibilities to explore. And, you know, the difficulty of that is you can't inject motivation or a questioning attitude into another person. You can't.
Yeah.
And in a way, the whole abduction experience, like most of ufology, I mean, it's an adjunct of it, is again based on seeing is believing. And what physics is telling us, that's not true. You know, it's not true. None of it's true. And so you have a lot of anti-intellectualism going around. You have a lot of reductionism. You have terrorism. Yeah. I mean, we're in a very strange place.
intellectual terrorism.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think there's a lot of unspoken nihilism going around. You know?
I never
really do.
You mean in the UFO thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I never really thought of it that way, but that really makes a lot of sense. Oh my, there's my next t-shirt.
There you go. And I think what's going on is that what I see in the social movement is a real contraction. And I think that's self-generated in that everybody can punch holes in everything, but there's nothing to replace it with. And so it almost becomes like a nihilistic exercise.
Yeah.
You know? And what I see in a lot of other people who formerly had the sense of exploration now seem to infer that even considering the complexities of it, they'd rather turn it into a cartoon. Or what I've seen are people who are formerly open-minded now become closet skeptics.
Yeah.
And they don't come out and say they're skeptics. They infer they're skeptics, which, you know, it's almost like, well, I don't really want to admit to myself or admit to you that I have some serious doubts whether any of this is explainable or not, you know?
Yeah.
So they tend to skew to the side of skepticism or making light of it, where I think you have to have a balanced perspective. I mean, you can't take it all that seriously, where it's a be-all and end-all of existence.
Yeah.
But it certainly, I think, by anybody's standard, it's still intriguing, but everyone seems to have contracted in a general state of depression. And then you have the circus with the Kodak slides, which I won't go into. But, you know, it sort of breeds that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it goes back, I think, it might go back to what I said, and, you know, I've repeated a couple of times. If you don't have some sort of an answer that you can hang on to, that's a definition of nihilism. But
yeah.
if you don't have some sort of answer you can hang on to, you just go right into, you know, I've got to make a decision. So my decision at this point is to not talk about the subject anymore, but to talk about the problems with the people that are interested in the subject that I think are stupid.
Right, because it's degenerated down to gossip.
Yeah. Somebody asked me today, they said, I got an email and somebody said, you know, he asked my opinion of the stuff he was doing. And he said, you said something nice about me, but then you implied that I did something, you know, I had done dumb stuff in the past. My only thing was, I don't care about anybody's stupid reputation. I really don't.
Right. Right. I mean, you know,
it's the minute I get involved in that, I stop caring about the stuff that you and I have been talking about for the past almost 2 hours now.
Well, it's a misdirection of attention.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't.
And you know what's so funny is,
I don't want that purity screwed up.
No, go ahead.
I said, I don't want that purity screwed up or the attempt at it.
Right. Right.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Right. But I think, you know, what's funny is, too, is that what I see is it's almost like there isn't any answer. So people are furiously going back into the past and taking a single case as a litmus test to the validity of the phenomenon.
Yes.
And what's so funny, it's like what we seem to have lost is a more global view of the phenomenon. Instead, it seems like a lot of people are kind of like trying to condense it into a manageable form and take one case as representative of all cases. It seems crazy.
I think I asked a question once online or made a post, and I said, does anybody know if there's ever been a case where one UFO looked exactly like the other ones. I mean, exactly like another one.
Right.
And I don't think there has been.
I'm not sure of the answer to that.
You're into perception there.
Yeah, I would think that there are close similarities, but the problem is with the evidence is that either
it was picked up by an imperfect instrument. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know it is. Then we get into social scripting again.
Yeah, and like I said, go ahead.
No.
It was picked up by an imperfect instrument in the first place. So how would they ever match?
Right, or there's a desire to make a match.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think a lot of that goes on. I really do, because you know what it is what's amazing is you get down into photographic analysis, or you know, and that's pretty much what we have, a witness testimony. And what's interesting is there's not enough information there. There just isn't. But at the same time, we have an equal and opposite reaction, almost Newtonian, where people say it's this or it's that. You know, this one resembles that one, where really it's an incomplete knowledge base. I mean, it just is.
Yeah.
And well, it's like everybody avoids uncertainty at all costs.
Yeah. Uncertainty and, as you said, complexity.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, and you know what's funny is, when you really look at the complexity of this, patterns do emerge in those spaces between A and B, and they're worth exploring. And oddly enough, ironically enough, those are the ones that aren't explored.
Can you give an example?
Well, yeah, I can. For example, the role of what we've been talking about is the phenomenon being a nexus of an information transfer that's out of context, that the prosaic, the normal, and the paranormal are linked at the hip, and that something is occurring that throws our semiotic and subconscious processes into disarray. And it's almost like a forensic examination of the human condition from without, or maybe more accurately, again, creating a third reality from the closed system of language and our dictionary of memories and associations that somehow mess with that and put it in an entirely out of place context. It's like nobody is looking at that as what lies between A and B. It's either a 56 Buick interstellar spacecraft, right?
Yeah.
Or it's demons, which nobody has, to my satisfaction, has ever described exactly what a demon is. You know, I mean, really.
So something that is unknown and challenges your ideas of reality is a demon.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. You know, you talk about in physics, you have Maxwell's demon. You know, the conservation of energy. How does that occur?
Oh,
is that a feedback process with information, or is there a little devil with horns? You know, controlling the temperature of any liquid, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what's really interesting, too, is the influence of the manifestation as an emotional carrier wave of fear.
Yes, yeah.
And it's like fear as a subconscious process that I think almost occurs quicker than we can process what's occurring. Almost like an instinct, I guess.
Do you think that the fear is entwined with some of the experiences because it we need it to be, or the precipitating agency needs it to be, or is it a natural outgrowth of what's going on that automatically, you know, increases novelty when it's going on? I think what I'm saying here is it an integral part of the experience because it needs to be in a natural way?
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Hmm.
I think, you know, I don't want to get into Freud's id, but in a sense, a lot of these things, again, whether we're talking biological processes, we're talking instinctual genetic messaging that is attached to fear. I mean, you know, we have a very strong survival instinct.
Yeah.
And so any uncertainty, I think before we can formalize an identification or association comes out with fear, that's an emotional carrier wave that overlays the entire experience.
Yeah, well, it sounds like, as you suggested, it needs to be there to carry the experience forward to a conclusion or to have it happen. I don't know which.
Well, I think it's something that simply is.
Yeah.
I don't think. I mean, as far as genetic evolution and all that and at our place in the natural world, I think it's been programmed into us, you know. I think it's programmed into us. And I think that what I think you're alluding to is sort of a parasitic relationship with what appears. In other words, what appears is borrowing from our vocabulary,
mm-hmm.
feeding it back in a sense to provoke us. And I don't think that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more happenstance than that. Because you have a lot of cases where that doesn't arise at all. You know,
Yeah, there's cases where there's just simply confusion or wonder or something like that.
Right, right. I think a lot of it has to do with some people are much more identified with certain concepts than other people are. And I think that has a bias toward generating fear, where some people don't have, you know, for example, like in religion. You know, fear is a big part of religion. You know,
some religions.
Pardon?
Some religions.
Yeah, correct. You know, it'd be interesting is to see a Taoist or a Buddhist confronted with experiential anomaly and get their take on it.
Yeah, well, that's when you were talking about this and the fear and the expectation and all that and the cultural encoding, and then when you mentioned religion, the first thing I thought of is, you know, what if a everybody wants to say the Dalai Lama, but you know,
or Christian,
fully,
or Christian,
yeah, or even Earth. Christian or anything like that. Any mystic who is fully engulfed in their engulfed in their cultural, you know, engulfed in the tenets of their religion, whereby.
Well, they're more in the driver's seat.
Yeah, they're not operating on fear, and they're more in a moment. And that,
yeah, they're not being driven; they're driving.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Yeah, you've taken the words out of my mouth. Exactly. And just to see how does an experience with something that we would call anomalous, how is that encoded through their consciousness, and how would they explain it to us?
Yeah.
I dare say, if there was somebody that was somebody that meditated all the time, was very in the moment, got to the point where they're in the moment, consciousness was there all the time. If they had to describe to us what they had seen, we wouldn't understand what they were talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, what's really interesting, when I got into the conversation with Combe, the shaman went further into his view or his perspective orientation toward the phenomenon. because Combe asked him directly, well, what is your take on this? And it was very interesting. He said, simply, it's a ghost. And his I would characterize it as a theology, is that, and it somewhat relates to Gurdjieff, which is kind of interesting, in that the shaman said that they were the dead trying, that had no place in space-time, but they developed a vehicle, now here's one, developed a vehicle to locate themselves within, and they were trying to,
Well, you're saying what you were saying at the beginning, where they would try to, it was the universe trying to find
others,
it.
Live through others, I guess, that's what I'm trying to say, live through others.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Borrow their consciousness in order to have a half-life.
What you were saying earlier.
It's really interesting how theology kind of
informs
its own imprint on our orientation as observers. You know, I really don't think there's such a thing as an objective observer. I really don't. Now, Rich would disagree with me on that.
Really? What do you think? Maybe we'll talk to him sometime on the show, but what do you think he'd say? What does he think the objective observer consists of?
Well, I think, and again, I don't want to speak for him.
That's okay.
I have too much respect for him to say that, but I would say that my impression is that he believes there is an objectified reality to it that witnesses are describing accurately.
Hmm.
And that and that seeing is believing. And we've gone, he and I have gone back and forth on this over and over again. And it's always an interesting dialogue with him.
Yeah. Well, as we've talked about for the last 2 hours now, seeing is probably a lie. Or not a lie, but seeing is an imperfect lens at best.
Right, because we experience nothing directly, to go back to what we were talking about earlier.
Right. It's always at a remove. It's at a remove through our senses and the 800 other things we've discussed.
Yeah. Well, it all goes back to Plato again. It was really interesting, that talk that Dean Radin moderated at Northwestern University today. And the person who was speaking, again, I really highly recommend somebody watch that who's interested. That lecture, because it really elegantly and simply explains the sort of complex mechanisms that take place in awareness.
Yeah.
And, again, I think everybody kind of, oh my God, it's too complex for me, we'll never figure it out. Therefore, it either doesn't exist or da-da-da-da-da, or we captured aliens in Roswell, blah, 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 and it's a big secret. Nobody wants to fund their space program as that being an incentive, to move forward. A lot of it is, it's self-comforting. It's a bomb.
Yes. B-A-L-M.
Yep.
We're at 10 o'clock now in just about 2 hours. Do you want to talk anymore? Continue it another time? What do you want to do, Bruce?
Well, we can continue it another time.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah, because it's late where you are. People don't know. Bruce has been very kind and stayed up till 1 o'clock there.
Whoa. I'm up past my bedtime.
Yes. So I will. At this point, I will thank you so much for coming on, and it's I don't know what serendipitous thing had you answer me when I said, oh, I don't have anybody on tonight.
Synchronicity.
Yes, that was it.
Well, I've really enjoyed my conversation with you. I think we've had a really good back and forth.
I think so. I think I contributed much less than you did, but the thing is, the best thing that can happen on this show apart from people enjoying it, is that I learned something. And I learned quite a bit in the last couple hours. Thank you so much, Bruce. And I will check out that stuff that you mentioned, especially that Valet stuff. That's I'd like to see what how he manifests some of these ideas. All right. Well, please keep in touch. Let's talk again soon, either on the show or off the show. And
sure.
When I've learned some more and have something something substantial to say, I will. We'll talk again.
Well, you and I both.
All right.
All right. Take care.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Wow, that was probably one of the best interviews in quite a while on this show. It made me very happy. And I want to thank Bruce Duensing very much for coming on at such short notice and agreeing to have this great talk.
She's the girl from the fourth dimension. We met once, as I recall. I gave her my close attention when she came walking through my wall. She's the girl from the fourth dimension. One kiss and my toes were curled. Our affair was too brief to mention, for she lived in another world. Other girls have height and width and breadth, but that is all. She had something extra, extra dimensional. Now she's back in the fourth dimension. It's better this way, you see, 'cause I only have three dimensions. She could never be happy with